Did the fullback bring him down? First time, maybe even second time. Still we go on. Juric has dribbled his way clear.
Welcome to the Round Ball Project. Happy New Year, everybody, to our wonderful listeners. And we've got a very good podcast for you today. Joining the podcast is multimedia journalist and filmmaker Michael Caine. This excerpt is taken directly from his site, Caine Media. Check it out. We'll put it in the description. But it says this: an accomplished journalist, broadcaster, television interviewer, producer, writer, editor, columnist, and corporate host, Michael is currently senior journalist for the Sydney's 10 News First and feature documentary creator for ESPN. Well known for his three-part documentary series, Passionate Players, which appeared on Network 10, uncovering the lives of entrepreneurs and how they made their fortunes. Caine is currently in post-production, which has been completed, and we'll talk about it today, with his all-exclusive feature with former Socceroo Mark Viduka, which is already aired on ESPN, as we've just mentioned before. He's also writes for 10 Daily, SBS World Game, and Inside Sport. And he's also the curator of the Nearly a Socceroo documentary, which aired on The Raw, detailing the life of Canberra-born Croatian legend Josip Simenic. Michael joins the podcast today to discuss a number of topics: his love for the Jets, the making of the Mark Viduka documentary, and the state of Australian football. Mammoth introduction, but I'm very happy to be speaking with you today on the wonderful Sunday evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. That was a magnificent introduction. I don't think I could do any better than that. very glad to join your podcast, mate. And I know I've been listening to a few already, and you're doing a fantastic job.
Appreciate it, Michael. You know, to hear that from someone who's I respect within the space, it's commends my respect. I thought, you know, as we do with all our guests, please just detail how you got into Australian football. And I guess what entices you about, you know, the love of the game?
Well, I suppose I got into doing this in a certainly different way. I'm not a trained journalist. I didn't go to university in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I didn't become a journalist at the age of 35, which surprises a few people. But from the age of 15 to 35, I was a tradesman. I was a carpet layer, believe it or not, you know, and to get to where I got, it wasn't easy, but I had to do it the hard way. But it was a way that probably was the best way, because I learned a lot in the process. And the good thing about it was I started off with football. Football was my great love. And I always say, if you're a budding young journalist that's trying to get a grip hold anywhere, play to your strengths. I suppose just like if you're a player on the field, you play to your strengths, and that was soccer. And so I started a little radio show in Newcastle, just on community radio, a football show called, I think it was called Football Frenzy, and which is now, God, it would be 2008, so about 12 years ago. And I didn't know what I was doing. I thought, God, you know, I'm 35 years old. It sounds like I'm having a midlife crisis. All my friends are going, what's Caine doing? Like, you know, he's gone mad, you know. But I had something. It was like a dream that I wanted to try to get to. And it's one of those situations where one thing leads to another. It really is. On this little show, you know, I used to invite so many well-respected guests, you know, Les Murray, Craig Foster, Simon Hill, Andy Harper, the who's who of the zoo when it comes to football in this country, in the hope that one day that, you know, if they were short of a journalist in television land, that I'd be that person that they snap up. And that's what actually happened. When the Newcastle Jets were flying high back then, they'd won the competition. They were playing in the Asian Champions League. SBS were covering a lot of the stuff after the matches in the presses. And one of their journalists became sick one day, and one of the fellows that I used to have on the show quite semi regularly, which was Dave Bashir from SBS, gave me a call and said, mate, I think you're about to get called up to do the interviews after an Asian Champions League game for the Jets. Make sure you answer that phone call. And I did. And it sort of it's almost like I jumped on this merry-go-round and it just kept moving. And one thing led to another. And next thing you know, I was covering a World Cup for SBS. And I'm still laying carpet. And it gave me that little bit of, I suppose, a foothold, a body of work, so to speak, which got me, got people sort of knowing who I was. And next thing you know, I was, working for the local television news in Newcastle, and it pretty much went from there. And to where I am today, it's a crazy ride.
Yeah, a crazy ride it is. And I think the craziest thing that's come out of, I guess, Australian football this year has been the resurgence of Mark Viduka within the mainstream. So obviously you managed to bring Mark into the public eye for the first time in 5 years, which commends and commands my respect, and it should command all 90,000 of those who watched that documentary on ESPN, traveling to his coffee shop, obviously, in Zagreb, and really just giving a very deep insight and sort of what really uncovering Mark Viduka. It's in the name, it's within the name, and just giving an insight on his thoughts of, journalists, Graham Arnold, the likes of. It's really a timeless piece of Australian football media and football media in general. Could you just give us some more details into sort of how this came to light? It's such a wonderful thing to see someone have that dedication to go to Croatia and interview one of the best we've ever had, and how obviously ESPN Australia picked up the rights for this feature.
It's quite incredible. It's nearly over a year now since I actually went to Zagreb. It was December 2019. So before COVID, before the outbreak, it swept worldwide. So I was very lucky in that sense. But to be honest, I was going to do a documentary just purely on Australian football. And as you know, Australian football's at a crossroads in many points. It's trying to be corrected at the moment, but I suppose we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But it was mainly to highlight what's going on in football in Australia, because every person that I interviewed, from Craig Foster to Simon Hill to Lucy Zelich, were worrying about the game. I mean, some of the stuff, there wasn't many highlights. It was almost like this depression, and it wasn't meant to be a depressing subject. I wanted some light, but it was really hard to get that light. So one of the persons that I spoke to was Ron Smith, which was the former AIS, Australian Institute of Sport coach, who's sort of like the godfather of the golden generation. They all love him. And with Mark, I mean, especially, he still keeps in contact with Mark to this day. And Smudger was so good that, honestly, he could be a documentary just purely by himself. The fact that, they closed the AIS down, which again is another story, which Mark does touch in it. But he, after the interview, I sort of spoke to him for about an hour after that. And I said, Mark Viduka's name come up. And I said, it's amazing that every person I've spoken to in all these interviews, Mark Viduka's name comes up. It's almost like, where's Mark Viduka? Where is he? What's he doing now? We don't even know where he is. Is he in Melbourne? Is he in Croatia? Is he in back in Leeds? No, nobody really knew. So it was like, wow, it was like finding Nemo, finding Mark Viduka. And so I sort of said to him, and Ron sort of said, well, I actually speak to him a fair bit, and I sort of said to him, well, would he appear on this documentary? And he went, well, I can only ask. So that'd be great if that happened. And Ron gave me a call, a few days later and said, look, he's begrudgingly said yes, but you better give him a call. And I spoke to him at length many times, before I went over. And I think the big kicker here was that the fact that when he realised that I was actually going to get on a plane and go over there, because he just thought it was just going to be over the phone, he sort of went, well, if you're going to do this, then I'll let this happen. So when that actually, came about, when I got over there, it was almost like there were so many taboo subjects which haven't really been brought to light. And this was the chance to do it. But then you sort of, I'm sort of thinking, it's going to get away from the core subject of the documentary, which was about Australian football, which I knew he was going to talk about. There's so many other things, like Harry Kewell, about, you know, his time at Leeds, the four goals against Liverpool, the Celtic move, how he nearly pulled out of that, his time, you know, in his early days in Melbourne, Croatia. It was almost like I got someone in the chair in front of me that very rarely you're going to have again, you know, and it's almost like you're only going to get one shot at this. And even when I was on the plane going over, I'm thinking to myself, this could actually swamp the documentary that I'm making. This could be bigger than the documentary. So I've got to make a decision whether to go and concentrate on doing it for the documentary, which at the time still hadn't had any backing or any, and nobody was taking it. It was almost like, you know, you've got to, these days you've pretty much got to go out there, make a documentary, make it really great. And even then there's probably just a pure like 10% chance someone will pick it up, you know? So when I got over there and I spent a day with him the day before, because I just wanted to get to know him. And as you know, he's got his own cafe in Zagreb now, which he owns with his wife. And I sat with him for 6 hours the day before, and we spoke about so many different things and a lot of things that I wanted to ask in the interview. And he was telling me so candidly, and I sort of thought, wow, you know, how great would this be if he actually drops these bombs on camera tomorrow? And I asked him that. I said, are you going to say this on when the camera's rolling? He said, if you want me to. And I said, wow, I'd love you to. And then I realized when I went back to my motel that night, I thought, this has to be a purely a Mark Viduka feature, you know, and the documentary is going to have to be pushed to the side. We might be able to use a few grabs for that, sure, but this is the core thing. This is going to make headlines if he's going to say some of the things that he actually says, which he ends up doing. But the funny thing about it, in a strange way, that documentary never saw light of day. And I apologise to nearly every one of those people that I've done the interviews for that we never saw, was that in the funny way that Mark Viduka's interview, which became it's solely holus bolus on him, actually, you know, did change a little bit of Australian football. Not everything, but it made people talk about the state of the game, which is the whole reason I wanted to do the documentary in the first place. So like a double clanger, it actually got a great result in having a great feature with someone that, you know, everybody reveres and loves as a player. And also it's made people talk about the game. And rightly or wrongly, it had to be talked about because there's so many different things and don't get me wrong, it's not all doom and gloom, you know, but as you know, there's a lot of crossroads which is still need to be ironed out before we can move ahead. Because, you know, when John Aloisi kicked that goal, scored that penalty in that qualifier against Uruguay in 2005, you know, we thought we were on the golden path, and we were. And in the last few years, we've somehow lost our way. And a lot of people, you know, just can't believe it happened so quick.
You know, actually, you spoke about, obviously, When Soccer Died, the documentary that was going to be created. And I think I really discovered this when Johnny Davidson put out a piece for SBS. Stating the following. This is sort of just an excerpt from that as well. Local filmmakers Michael Caine and Oscar Vieira are behind the project that will tackle topics such as the national curriculum, the waning youth production line, the state of A-League expansion, the Socceroos and women's football. With the working title of When Soccer Died, the duo have interviewed many powerful figures in Australian football, from ex-Socceroos to broadcasters, coaches, administrators, former Matildas and officials, to explore how the sport in Australia has lost its way. Now, obviously, you've spoken about how the documentary unfortunately did not come to light, possibly paving the way for something even grander than that, in that obviously Viduka documentary and also that Simonich documentary. But if you were to sort of revisit that in a way, how would you, in this current space and time, I believe about a year and a half since you stopped working on it. Is that correct? Yeah. About a year and a half.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's hard because when you're filming stuff, as you know, like things change all the time. Like a lot of stuff that you can film one day can be redundant the very next day if something happens and has to be chucked out. So it's almost like this a lot of those interviews, it's like we've evolved from them. You know, a lot of this stuff was talking about the AIS. Why did the AIS close? Why did they make that decision? Well, we've already now, you know, since the Paducah thing, that's been talked about. So again, you couldn't even go back to those tapes and go, you know, let's revisit this documentary. You really have to start from scratch. And that was the biggest thing, was that, I mean, at the time, I was a Channel 10 employee, and I'm not anymore. I took a redundancy nearly 3 months ago, and which is the best thing I've ever done. But I, at the time, I mean, here I was as a Channel 10 employee doing an independent thing, which means that I'm doing it in my own time, and you need a cameraman that wants to do it in his own time. And cameramen make a lot of money these days. You know, a cameraman, a news cameraman, would make anywhere between $800 to $1,500 a day. So for him to forego that, it has to be done in his own time. You've got to remember too, you know, we've all got families as well. So it's a real labor of love if you want to do something like this. So it's very hard to do that. And even once you do finally do this, you know, you've got expenses like editing. You know, an editor is $1,000 a day. And we put some money into it, but it's almost like you need that backer. And to get that backer, you need someone like an SBS, like an ESPN, like a Fox Sports. And that's another hard thing too, because you've got to remember too, I was a Channel 10 employee, and take, for example, Fox Sports didn't want a bar of it when I presented it to them and said, have a listen. Same with SBS. Maybe there's that embarrassment of, well, why didn't our guys do that? You know, we've got someone from another channel doing this for us. This is going to look really weird on us. And so you've got to go through that hurdle as well. And thank God ESPN jumped in and saw what it was. And I got in a lot of trouble at Channel 10 for doing it, and I don't regret it. And it probably put me on the wrong side of a few people from that point on. Because when it was aired that morning, it was just everywhere. It was every website. You know, the newspapers the next morning. You know, Channel 7 News, Channel 9 News. The only news it wasn't on was Channel 10, my own, because they were filthy that I'd actually gone and done it for ESPN, and maybe rightly so, but it was one of the best things I've ever done. It was like old fashioned journalism. You're going out there on a hunch, and sort of you're going to go all that way, and it's almost like you've got to come up with something, and it's almost like you bring your A game. You have to get it, and I did. But again, you know, just getting it over the line was just as hard as actually doing it. I mean, I think doing the interview was the easy part. It's the post-production and trying to find that person, that organization that wants to actually air it. That's the hardest thing. And you know, that's a lot of people don't realize, you know, people come to me and go, hey, let's do a story. Let's do a documentary on the history of Australian football. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, we could do it, but where's it going to be shown? Oh, no, SBS will pick it up. No, they won't. You know, it sounds great. They should. They probably should, because they're such a, you know, multicultural, and football's been their backbone for so long. But it's changed. You know, it's changed so much now. There's no such thing as a world game department apart from a couple of people sitting on a website and doing a couple of blogs and, you know, podcasts, you know, a week. That's your world game program, you know, where when I first got to SBS, you know, in 2008, 2010, you know, there was a sea of people. You know, it was a department by itself, the World Game Department. Now it's just, it's nothing. It's actually really sad. So that's the hardest thing as a filmmaker, as a budding filmmaker, and not just for football, for anything. You know, and you've got to jump through hoops to get things over the line. And you can go and do a lot of work and film a lot of things. But and you could have the greatest thing going. You could have the best thing. But if you haven't got the backer to put it to air, it don't mean anything. It don't mean shit.
And I guess that's really unfortunate within the mainstream. And I guess it's really sort of, it's funny how the things that you're saying and the words of wisdom that you provide, it's feeding into my upcoming questions, which is fantastic. I guess on the tangent of the state of Australian football and when people bring these wonderful content pieces to light, obviously working within the mainstream being Channel 10, and you've seen how football is perceived within that sort of environment. How do you feel that the A-League and W-League is perceived, and the Socceroos holistically. I mean, European football is another subject in itself. I view it as something separate. Obviously, I'm not sure if you were at Channel 10 when they had the A-League free-to-air rights, but within, I guess, that certain environment, did you feel a bit disrespected, or was it sort of a matter of...
I think myself and a few other journalists who are not at other certain networks as well, and I don't have to name them, you know, most people know who they are. They're people that actually stood up to the establishment, and they paid the price. And the people that are still in the game now are people that are just, they're almost like they're survivors in the sea. You're looking for the life raft, hoping one day that, you know, Fox Sports or, you know, will re-employ them or something's going to turn up. You can't be like that these days. You've just got to go and do what you want to do now, I think. When I was at Channel 10, yes, we had the Saturday night A-League game, which sounds great. But again, it doesn't really mean anything when you're just taking Fox Sports coverage. You know, you were taking their commentary. Even when SBS had it, at least they had their own commentators. The thing was that it had to be on free-to-air somewhere. Channel 10 were paid $1 million a season to air it. And that's the only reason they showed it, because they had no interest in it. And I went upstairs once. I said, you know what? You guys would actually get a good viewership if you actually promoted it more. And they said, well, why? It's like a paid ad. You know, the FFA has given us all this money to play it on a Saturday night. Why should we have to spend money on advertising it? It's like a paid commercial. That's the easiest term you can put into a two-hour commercial on a Saturday night, which then they put it on a back channel, which, you know, for some reason people don't like going to back channels like SBS2 and Demand, you know, Viceland, all that sort of thing. Like, people like to go to the main channel. But even those big blue derbies and things like that, you know, you could have put it on the main channel and actually had an audience if it was promoted correctly. I even went one step further. I used to go upstairs and say, you know, with all these rights deals and stuff that's going on, I'm going, guys, you know, it's sitting there for the picking, football in this country, the A-League. You know, it's probably at its bargain basement price. You would pick it up cheap and turn it into something, just like you did with the Big Bash. You know, it was nothing when you got it. And then all of a sudden it's worth something, and you got Channel 7 and Fox Sports fighting over it. And now you lose it. It's almost like they had it sitting there and they just don't realise it. They'd rather, you know, because they put a lot of money into, you know, covering the Wallabies and Rugby Union, Supercars, two sports that they're about to lose as well, although they've already lost the rugby. It was craziness. It was almost like, you know, I was going upstairs and I'm begging them, you know, you've got to do something with this, you know. So it was like banging your head against a wall. But the A-League's not regarded that great with the, you know, commercial networks. I mean, I know that now that we've got the Women's World Cup, in a few years' time, this should be the golden carrot, because you've got to remember that the free-to-air networks do want the Women's World Cup. And this is where that should be the bargaining chip. But if you're going to give it to a free-to-air network, there's got to be a clause in place where you're not going to bury it at midnight like Channel 7 did years ago with a station called C7, where the NSL used to be on a package like about midnight.
and now a highlight show.
You've got to actually play them, you know. And to be honest, people say, you know, the football people say that putting it on some of the back channels is disrespectful. But at the end of the day, too, you know, the football people that love football are going to watch it. You know, they're going to get to that channel. But this is the worry, too, with the FFA and doing the streaming thing, which I think should happen. Are we preaching to the already converted? Because you've got to give it to some people that might want to go, hey, I really like football. I'm going to watch this more often. Look, in the last couple of weeks since the A-League started, you know, the standard's been great, and it's been really watchable, you know. And it's in that time zone of the year where here we are, we're going to look at, you know, moving it back to winner code. And I was speaking to a guy who's in marketing, and he said, why? He said, man, you know, like, there's nothing on between Christmas and New Year. It's like the Big Bash, you know. It's like, that's why people were transfixed watching Big Bash, because nothing else on, you know, Test cricket, Sydney to Hobart. But maybe, you know, in this time of year, just to kick off leading into Christmas, is the perfect time to have a football competition. And I know the purists don't like that, but you remember we're in competition with three other football codes. You know, we've got to be smart, and you know, maybe that's the way to do it. But there's so much conversation that needs to be done and said, but it needs to be done quickly. You know, it really is a lot of people are sort of looking at the future, going, "What's this like?" And we just show them. I mean, we've got the talent. We've got the local talent that can pull it off. And I hear people. I read people on Twitter saying, "You know, how great is the standard be? All you doomsdayers." Well, guess what? They're professional footballers. I want that standard to be good. I expect that standard to be good. I'd hate for it not to be good. So while we shouldn't be celebrating, it's great. It's great that it's great. But, you know, there's more worries, you know, that lie ahead than just whether, you know, our homegrown talent can, you know, produce the goods on the television.
And I think it really speaks to, I guess, the quality that we saw yesterday, especially with the two games. Obviously, when this comes out, this will be on the Sunday. And yesterday we had the Brisbane versus Melbourne victory game, which I attended as a part of the media, and the Wellington versus Sydney FC game. Now, albeit obviously the technical issue with Fox Sports, those two games were cracking fixtures. You know, Callum McManaman in that first half looked absolutely outstanding, and those there are at least four proper football goals, which I'd reckon if they got thrust into the mainstream from a mainstream broadcaster, not ABC Sport, but for example, a Channel 7, a Channel 10, that'd be plastered across every newspaper where you go.
Some of those goals that were scored, if you put a Real Madrid shirt or a Barcelona shirt or a Manchester City shirt on those players, and that was actually a Premier League or a La Liga game, you know, they probably would have shown it on their mainstream channel on their news that night.
Yeah,
that's the difference.
You couldn't be more right. And I think that's really the state we're in right now. And you know, I'll address this to all football fans who are listening to this. The media week numbers that come out are rendered, in my opinion, somewhat irrelevant. If you look on soccer Twitter, everyone's watching on KO and MyFootball. It's not the Foxtel box is not an accurate depiction of where football fans are right now. So I think to look at that as the benchmark for where we stand within the general media is not true.
And that's true to a point, but at the same time too, I mean, a lot of people are saying, "Oh well, you know, like just take for example what happened last night with the goal that wasn't shown." I mean, that's what happens when you cut costs, you know, things like that happen, and that's purely what happened. And you got to think, you know, Fox Sports, as much as people might be thinking, well, they're going to leave us next year, so it doesn't really matter. One, we don't really know that for a start. You know, they still could offer a deal because, hey, you know, the numbers could be good. You know, they're still the host broadcaster, so their standards still should be high, right up to the very end. Right, we shouldn't just go, "Oh well, they're leaving us anyway." You know. Because again, if they decide to go for another 3 years, and I've heard that they are thinking about putting another bid in, but personally, I think it would be disastrous. I think we've just got to move on and start looking at new ideas because that's the worry to clubs. The unbundling, they might just take the easy route and say, "Well, we've got enough worries to, you know, with our own clubs. You know, Fox Sports are going to offer us X amount for the next 3 years. Let's just take it. That's one thing we don't have to worry about." That's a worry. It's a real worry.
And I think I've obviously had conversations with individuals who have worked within Optus Sport. I can't say I know anyone who works with Stan Sport or Channel 9. The seeming pipe dream of Optus Sport picking up the A-League rights. If this were to not eventuate, which in my opinion will be pretty likely, I think we will have a bidding war of some sorts, but not to the extent of what we had with the Big Bash or something like that. Obviously, we're a product which has been undermined for many years. If the Optus Sport, I guess, dream doesn't eventuate, where does this leave Australian football with the options that we have on the table currently?
Well, I think I can't see Optus Sport taking the A-League. I think they're pretty much happy with what they've got. you know, and they've got some, you know, if you've got the EPL and you know, some European games, great. People are always going to watch those, you know. And with the A-League, I mean, it's a risk. And a lot of, you know, networks, whether they're free-to-air or not, they don't like taking risks anymore. And that's the worry. So, mate, again, there's this talk about the mainstream of having a you know, like an FFA TV, which would be great. You got to remember too. Look how bloody popular the FFA Cup is. You know, people still love that rawness of a state league team. You know, to me, it's like play to your strengths. And as you know, the state league federations, they have a lot of streaming with a lot of their games. It gets a lot of viewership. It's building up. Getting budding commentators and people wanting to talk about the game, which is a great thing. You know, it's about converting that maybe into a higher, you know, into the next level, into the A-League, into a second tier, relegation promotion. I don't know about, it's still a long way away, I think. But maybe start a B-League that doesn't have a relegation promotion. Get those teams.
Yeah, the national second. Yeah, that's a happening thing. That's going to be, from my understanding, there'll be an announcement. Sorry to interrupt, but there's going to be an announcement on the 8th of January. 6th or 8th of January from the AAFC, in which they'll give some more information about the modelling criteria for the National Second Division.
And that's brilliant. That's brilliant. But again, it's a case of getting these teams up to speed with where they need to be, whoever they are. Whether they're, you know, some new clubs, state league clubs. I mean, there's some state league clubs that could probably walk straight into the A-League. They're so well equipped, you know. Like clubs like South Melbourne.
South Melbourne most definitely could, yeah.
They're strong. Their administration, even look at their website. It's as good as any A-League website, you know. And so there's the support there as well. Now's the time to probably look at doing that. But let's not rush into it. I know this is another problem too. We're still in uncharted waters. So let's have a look first and test the water before we maybe put a relegation promotion system in. There's clubs in the A-League that are teetering at the moment, you know? The Jets and the Mariners. The Newcastle Jets, mate, JobKeeper saved the Newcastle Jets. COVID-19 saved the Newcastle Jets because they didn't have the money to pay their staff. That was the only reason that joint kept going over this COVID-19 period was JobKeeper. And that's a real worry. They're still in the middle of looking at some overseas investors. I'm told there's a few from the US, which I think it's going to be too late for them. I think the clubs will have to come in and save them. And, you know, hopefully they can keep going. Because, I mean, I'm from Newcastle and it's such a massive sport up in the Hunter. And it's such a proud history. And to lose an A-League franchise would be an absolute travesty. Or not a travesty, but just it'd be heartbreaking. Because, again, there's so much history. And, you know, I know there's a lot of other areas like Wollongong and Gold Coast and Canberra that would snap up that licence. But, you know, let's hope that they can just keep going through this period. And I know that Laurie McKenna is doing his utmost.
Yeah, I mean, Laurie McKenna is doing a fantastic job. He's really held up the shop there. You know, to deal with that Bernie Abini fiasco and obviously the now Steve Nugarkovic stuff, obviously that's not entirely within his hands. But Laurie McKenna's done a fantastic job at maintaining that club. That club's presence in the Hunter region, and I even see, you know, the media releases that I get sent, the way they undertake their press conferences and stuff like that. It's still done on a very professional standard, and I really hope that club can survive in some capacity. They've had a pretty rough off season, as you would expect, but I reckon they've got enough talent to possibly not finish bottom or in those bottom three slots of the league, despite the result on Thursday evening. Moving into A-League Independence, which was finalised on New Year's Eve, to the joy of hundreds of football fans and to the confusion of many as well. Why did this take so long? And how will this potentially transform the game for the better? Michael, you also mentioned this on Twitter. You mentioned this to me as well. Wasn't this finalised months ago? Obviously, the legalities has been ironed out now. But why did this take so long to iron out?
Well, I think maybe, I mean, Paul Lederer, you know, I'm pretty sure in an interview nearly 12 months ago, said it was a matter of time before it was it was all going to be done and dusted, and here we are 12 months later, it's happening, and to all the fanfare. And I don't know, I mean, I just sort of think to yourself, well, look at the launch of the league. I mean, what type of launch it was. I mean, that caused some, a lot of tongues wagging as well of how poor that was. But who was in control of it then? I mean, obviously the FFA, but it's almost like someone should have had the foresight to say, hey, we've got to put on something professional here. Whether you own it now or we own it, who owns it, I don't know. Let's just do something, put our heads together and do something professional. And it's almost like, the FFA didn't want to do anything because they're about to get rid of it. The clubs didn't want to do anything because they hadn't had it yet. So it's a case of stepping up. And I think, hopefully this the APL, can really be a leader in that way, because it was like a rudderless ship the last 12 months. And it's, I suppose it's like the English FA, they concentrate on the national teams, just like the Football Australia will concentrate on the national teams here. And we needed that strong independence, that has everything, which it has, obviously a board of directors, everything from, obviously chairman, media department, everything like that. It needs to be rolled out, just like the Premier League does, in England. So it really needs to start thinking beyond outside the square and quickly. I'm just glad it's done. It's just done and dusted. We just get on with it now.
Yeah.
Because obviously there was, all the contractual arrangements with Fox that wouldn't have helped as well, because that was getting held over their head that if the cord was severed, months and months ago, then Fox Sport could have walked out with a null and void contract. So that had to keep going. So I think that, now that they've got this board in place, now that they've got some sort of assurity of what's going on into the future, now they can start making some big decisions, for the good of the game, because that's what the hordes are wanting. And there's so many people that love this game. You know that. Everybody knows that. And it's almost like it's a game that, we were on the cusp of being that game that everybody wanted it to be a few years ago, as I mentioned earlier. And where are we now? It's sad in a way, It makes me want to do another documentary. I went to a football writers festival, and it was almost like I had to speak about the Viduca thing, but I also had to do a one-on-one with Craig Foster. And the brief was to talk about his work doing humanitarian stuff, which has been brilliant.
Yeah.
But even it's almost like it morphed onto the state of the game and where it needs to be. When it was like everybody, it was the easiest interview ever, because you just what Craig Foster's like. He just went on and on and on, and people were hanging off every word. It was almost like we needed that, because some people like that are so passionate. And the sad thing about it is there's people similar to that are so passionate that are locked out of the game because there's just nowhere for them to have a voice.
Yeah.
Some of these big name people in media are now, doing columns for the FFA, I mean, which is great. It keeps them in a job, but are they going to do that investigative journalism if the Football Australia need to come under fire, or is it a PR piece? It's not their fault. They're just trying to stay in the game.
And I guess, and I guess that real sort of ruggedness and rigidity that, I wouldn't say rigidity, but that sort of vigor that writers do have and that Australian football writers did have. We look at what News Corp used to be, what the Herald Sun used to be, and obviously that's a byproduct of Foxtel. And that's why we don't really have that nowadays. But something that comes to mind is the, I think, 32 ways in which the FFA have stuffed up in the past year, which was a famous piece by Matt Windley and David Davidovich a couple of years ago when David Gallup was at the helm. So that's something that really came to mind. And you look at guys who have been, I guess, locked out of the game, if you will, and are now suddenly getting a voice. We all know who we're talking about. We're not going to say his name, but we all know who we're talking about here. And I think the fact that he's given the wonderful opportunity to have multiple avenues to express his opinions, it's been an absolute blessing. One of the shining lights within the game as well. And I guess the stories that can be uncovered, such as the Mark Viduka story, the Simonich story and the likes of, the Timothée story as well is something that I'm really fascinated about as well.
Good stories. That's the sad thing about it. There's so many good stories, but it's hard to bring them to life on so many levels. One, we haven't enough people to do them and get them on that platform, because mainstream people need to listen to this. They're good stories. The Viduka piece was nominated for a Walkley, which was an honour for ESPN to do that, and it didn't get shortlisted, didn't get to the final. And one of the pieces that were in there, and this is no disrespect, to the person, but just an example, there was an expose on the Brisbane Broncos. That was one of the finalists for this Walkley Awards. And I mean, as the Viduka thing, was read and seen, in many parts of Europe, Australia. It had so many different talking points. Every media wanted a piece of it.
Influenced the FFA, well, a large contributor to the starting 11, which is now a mainstay of the FA.
Exactly right. And it's almost like, I'm sure that the people of Southeast Queensland would have loved that Brisbane Broncos story, just like the Australian Media Awards, where the Viduka piece got snubbed as well. Again, it sounds like I'm sour grapes, but we had a Des Hasler story, a feature piece on Des Hasler. Again, great writing. He's a great writer. But you're comparing apples and oranges. And I mean, if you're talking about that went a lot further than north of the peninsula, in the peninsula of Sydney, I was puzzled in regards to that. But, I suppose another thing in a way is that the position we're in this country in regards to where football is positioned, that a piece like that doesn't even make the final of some of these awards because they see AFL and rugby league far more important.
And I guess that's, I think, what we have to come to grips with, as James Johnson always says, we're our own sport, football first, and that's how it should be, and that's how it always should be, and always has been.
And I hear people say football too. I mean, again, the Sydney Morning Herald, they've gone back to calling it soccer again. That little heading. They went from soccer to football, and now it's back to soccer again. What happened then? No one's explained this to me, and I know it's a little thing, but we got our identity back, and there's nothing wrong with calling it soccer either. Don't get me wrong, but it's just those little things like that. And you think, if people like Mike Cockerell was still around, at the Sydney Morning Herald, what would he be saying about it? Would he just cop it? I don't think so. I think he'd be, filthy, and he'd be telling them about it.
I do think the Herald, though, above all else, sorry to interrupt, but I think they are head over heels, probably the best at covering the game tenfold.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's what we need. We need that. Vince does and Co does a brilliant job. But it's just those little things, It's almost like all of these clubs have changed their name to football clubs. What do we do? They change it back to soccer clubs now? I don't know. I'm confused. When it comes to marketing, marketers, advertisers want to know, well, what code are you? Are you soccer or are you football? I don't know. Let's be assured of ourselves. Let's not back away, and let's stand up to the other codes.
Yeah, rightly so. Rightly so.
We're the biggest sport in the world. We have every right to puff out our chest and say that we are. But at the moment, it feels like we're just sort of, running and hiding. We shouldn't be doing that. Let's get stuck into them.
Yeah, I think let's get stuck into it for sure. And I think we've got a long way to go. An absolute long way to go. And I think capping off this year, in Australian football, tumultuous, plenty of lows, but one glaring high being we have the rights to the Women's World Cup. And I'll tell you what, bargaining chip. That's what we use it as for TV right deals. And I really hope it is. But Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure to come on the podcast. As we do see here, as the MacArthur versus Central Coast Mariners game has just been completed, with the Mariners gaining their second consecutive victory, first time since December of 2017. What a story that is. But MacArthur spoiled on their home debut.
Great news. You know what I mean? Like two wins in on the trot. You know, and again, that's another little town that loves their football. And you know, let's keep these little clubs alive, because that's what football's all about, is having the battler in the mix that can always spring a surprise or an upset. That's what we love about this game.
And that's what it's about. It, you know, Alan Stajic, the battle of the Matildas coaches, and Stajic came on top, which is a brilliant and wonderful thing. To all listeners, you know, listening still, I hope you are. We've got a new sponsor we're announcing imminently. The next episode will be out in a couple of days. We've got Kevin Ayres coming on. We'll speak about a game of two halves and more. Another light in the midst of darkness, it seems. But Michael, obviously, thanks once again, and hopefully we can hear from you very soon. Another documentary for us, please. We'll see what happens. But all the best. Happy New Year, and thank you soon.
Thanks, Neil. It's been a pleasure.